Hello, you're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Hooligan. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Weekly and Las Vegas Sun. My guest today is UNLV political scientist and friend of the program, Dave DeMore. Dave, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're going to address, I think, a number of subjects this week. The first, though, is my column that was in the Las Vegas Weekly, in which I argue that we have too many elections. And by that, I question whether or not we should be electing a bunch of jobs that we don't know what the job is, and we don't know the people who are anything about the people who are running for them. And so, Dave, I'm going to ask you as a quiz: who did you vote for in the 2010 Clark County Recorder's race?
Whoever the incumbent was, because okay. I thought they were doing a great job.
All right. I think that's your way of saying you have no idea who you voted for in the recorder's race. Do you know what the recorder does?
I do know the recorder because I've been in the recorder's office a couple of times. Pretty much any public document that you have to file, property deeds of trust, obviously, for your property, that's where you go to do it.
So they essentially record public documents.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm arguing is that this is not a job. I don't understand why we would elect someone to do this. It seems like an administrative task that the county manager could assign someone to do.
A staff member, for instance.
Right.
I think, you're absolutely right at one level, but it goes against sort of the ethos of the West, if you will. This notion of, you want limited government and you want lots of responsiveness and lots of oversight here. And we see that throughout our whole system of government about it in some of the other Western states here. So I think that's ultimately where it comes from, is that idea that we want this control over our elected officials, no matter what the actual job they're doing.
The reality is, though, that we don't know much about these people who are running.
Unless they get involved in some sort of scandal. Absolutely. Uh-huh. That's the only time you're going to really hear about this. But, yeah, you can think about, they're out there on the campaign trail. You don't really see that. But they do have to raise some money. Occasionally you will see signs. So they have to hit up some donors on that. And I don't quite know what the solicitation would be for that.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to be a much better public recorder.
Exactly. I mean, again, if you're following someone who got involved in some sort of scandal, then maybe. But outside of that, and you're competing with everybody else trying to raise money, it just seems like kind of an odd thing.
Mm-hmm. And in recent history here in Nevada, I think we did have an example of that. The public administrator,
mm-hmm.
I think, was accused of taking bribes hidden in teddy bears.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that not too long ago on that one.
And so the campaign that followed that, I imagine, hinged on let's clean up the county administrator.
Exactly. Let's throw the buttons
and the public administrator. I should also note, as I learned this week, that person is in charge of essentially estates where there's no executor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the public administrator, the elected public administrator, takes care of that. What do political scientists say about all these elections?
Well, there's a couple of things we have to say about this. The first, if you look sort of comparatively, we ask people to vote more often and for more things. So our ballots typically are much, much longer.
You mean than other
countries,
developed countries?
Yeah, other democracies. So you have much longer ballots, right? So you have federal races, state races, local races, constitutional questions, ballot initiatives, then all the judges. And we also make you ask people to vote more frequently, right? So mm-hmm. if you want to be a good citizen in the United States, you're talking about voting, every municipal primary, every municipal general election, every, regular primary election, then every either midterm or general election. And don't forget your recalls and your special elections.
Uh-huh. And I recall, this got former Vice President Dick Cheney in trouble. He didn't vote in some Dallas municipal elections.
Absolutely. And so, you open yourself up to that. And you look at the turnout in those municipal elections, and they're very, very small.
Right.
Which lays the question, they're very expensive to run elections. So why don't we just run them on the even number years when we run the regular, the midterm elections? And the argument for that is, these are sort of separate. We don't want them being corrupted by the partisan rancor at the top of the message, because all these things are nonpartisan here. And it was this idea that they should be separate elections here. But it's very, very costly to do, and you have very, very low turnout.
Uh-huh. And when you go into the booth and you're voting a nonpartisan election, you have even less information than if it were a partisan.
Absolutely. You're missing that cue of Democrat or Republican, which conveys, you know, a fair amount of information, particularly lower down the ticket. You can have some idea how people are going to behave in office. So what do you look for? Well, you look for incumbency. Mm-hmm. You look for gender. You look for ethnicity. Those sort of things loom a little bit larger when those issues aren't there. The other thing, of course, we know is that a lot of people simply don't vote for those races. Right? We have high numbers of roll-off when you go farther down the ballot. Even when we sort of report our turnout, you know, we'll have a high water turnout in that presidential election this November. Even on that same ballot, when you get down even to your state legislative races, you know, pretty important because those people make some pretty important decisions.
Some people still don't vote in those
races. Some people
races.
Don't even vote for even for the congressional races. You'll see roll off.
They
on
just
that.
Write on.
They just go in, vote for president. You know, maybe they'll vote for the Senate race because it'll be a highly salient Senate race. But
was there a lot of that in 2008? I suspect there was.
There was absolutely.
People
was.
Just went in, they hit Obama, and they walked out.
Mm-hmm. Because that's you know what they've been primed to do. That's really all they knew. Because particularly in a general election. The president's on the ballot, you really draw in a lot of marginal voters, and that's what they're energized for. You know, someone their work said, you got to go out there and vote, you know. And then they get there and they're like, oh boy, what are all these other things
here?
Yeah,
what's all this other nonsense?
Exactly. I don't want to vote for
county public administrator.
Exactly. Right. All these judges and whatnot on that one there. And obviously in the West, in the initiative states and in the referendum states, you obviously have that as well, where you're not only just voting for candidates, you're now voting for public policy.
Right. Complicated public policy questions that most people don't know anything about, and we ask them to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about one of the more controversial elected positions or the controversies over whether or not they should be elected or appointed, and that's judges. We elect judges here. How common is that in the United States?
It's very common. 39 states use elections at some level to do that. A lot of them will have what's called the Missouri plan or something along these lines where you have appointed process, then you have retention elections like that. Most of them are nonpartisan, but there are a few states, most notably Texas, where the partisan labels are on there.
Do you elect a Republican or a Democratic judge?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In Texas, you elect a Republican.
Probably so. And even the Democrats there aren't really, you know, Democrats like the rest of the country. On that one there. So you do, I mean, yeah, it provides them the more, a little more information. But the broader issue when we talk about judicial races is the fundraising side of it, right? And particularly now where you're seeing in some of these states where the judges have handed down some controversial abortion decisions or gay rights decisions, you now have outside groups coming in running, you know, these issue advocacy campaigns in these, you know, judicial races, which used to not get a whole lot of attention here. So it's very much changed the dynamics, and the whole point of judges are supposed to be above politics and out of politics, but now you have this, the electoral connection brings them right back.
So you've got interest groups. Now, it seems to me the other potential group to raise money from would be attorneys.
Absolutely, the people who are going to be in front of you, because, you know, outside of that, most people don't really think about judges unless you're involved in the legal profession, right? You interact with judges on a daily basis here. So yeah, you're actually then raising money from the people who are going to be in front of your courthouse and that, or in front of your bench, and that creates another set of potential problems here, conflicts of interest, potential corruption, and those types of issues there. But at the same time, as we saw in Nevada, right, people don't want to do it. Everybody thinks this is probably a bad idea. Last time around, we had an initiative on the measure on the ballot to essentially adopt the Missouri plan, right, have a sort of appointment process.
We would appoint the judge, but then after a period of time, they'd go in front of the voters for retention or not.
Mm-hmm. And that failed at the ballot box. And even though, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor came here and campaigned, and that's one of her big sort of post-retirement.
Former Supreme Court Justice.
Yes, Supreme Court Justice.
She hates the election.
Absolutely, she does. Absolutely does. So she's, you know, been advocate of this along with some other groups out there. But it's a really tough sell.
And that
sell.
Lost in 2010 here in Nevada. And what I thought was interesting there was a lot of people did not vote for any judge. They, as you said, they were roll-off. They only voted at the top of the ticket, either for Harry Reid or Sharon Angle in the top races. They did not vote for any judges, but then they voted against the idea of appointing as opposed to electing.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is there's just such distrust in government here that why would I want to lengthen the leash, if you will, of government, you know, lose my control over it there. And the second point is, yeah, you take that away. I'm not going to exercise that right, but I don't want someone taking it away from me in the abstract there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see that across the board in this moment we are in politics. So there's just such anti-government environment out there that any attempt to sort of think about making changes to improve governance that have to result in going to the voters or changing a constitution or something on those lines, they fail. Instead, what we end up seeing is the other side in the initiative states, particularly term limits, two-thirds tax thresholds, right, caps on the size of the budget. So all these sort of restraints are what
throwing sand in the gears of government.
Exactly, what wins at the ballot box, and the time to sort of say, well, how can we think about creating institutions that might allow us to better govern? Those are going to fail.
There's a lot of ironies there. Now let's talk about why people often don't vote for judges. It seems to me the biggest impediment to voting for a judge, one judge over another, is just lack of information.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd like to think of myself as a fairly well-informed voter out there. So where do you go for sources? Well, you know, the paper puts out the tab, you know, gives you some background information of them. You see the judges on the review journal. They do that annually. But that's about it, unless you're going to go website from website and look up these people. And then, you know, they don't really talk about, they're sort of constrained in what they can talk about during the race. So you're kind of, again, you're going back to sort of demographic characteristics. Where'd they go to school, right? What's their race? What's their gender? You know, age, those kinds of things there. Maybe if you're savvy, you might say, well, they got a red sign, so maybe they're Republican, or they have a blue sign, maybe they're Democrat. But yeah, it's a really tough sell on that to get people just the information on that. And, you know, they are raising money, and that's a problem there, but they don't have enough money to make a really credible campaign.
So too many elections. I think we're all in agreement. Moving on, Governor Brian Sandoval recently announced that he supported the extension of taxes that were passed in 2009. They were set to sunset.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislature stop them from sunsetting, and so they've continued, but they're supposed to sunset again. But the governor says he would like those taxes to continue. There are small tax increases on sales tax and modified business tax, which is essentially a payroll tax. Why do you suppose he did that?
Well, he's got a 63% approval rating, I think would be the short answer to that question. And I think, you know, more generally, I mean, the strategic point of it was you sort of look at some of the polling data out there, and it's moving against the Republicans. They sort of seem to, the public seems to say, well, they've been sort of captured by their base. They're not really interested in governing. So this is a way, and I think you had a piece on this, which I thought was a good piece, to sort of say this is a path towards moderation here. And it takes a huge campaign issue off the table, right? Because everybody's seen the cuts here. Everybody has kids in schools, or they have neighbors who have kids in schools, or their kids go to college, and they see the consequences of this. Now, he's not talking about restoring funding to pre-cut levels. He's just providing basically a floor for the budget here. And what I thought was interesting was you saw some of the folks who were so adamant in the last session saying, no way, no way, even after the Supreme Court Clean Water Coalition hearing came down, which sort of forced the issue on the governor and allowed him to sort of get away from that campaign promise. They were saying, no, 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 and vote against it. Now they're all lining up behind it.
Uh-huh.
You know, mostly Greg Brower and Michael Roberson, for example,
right,
on the Republican
and
side.
And Roberson is running the campaign,
mm-hmm,
to take the Senate for Republicans.
And in many cases, you notice he's gone for more moderate candidates when he's had a chance to choose between sort of more Tea Party, more conservative candidates versus more moderate ones. And he's chosen the moderate ones because they have a better chance of winning in some of these swing districts.
He's looked at the maps.
He's looked at the maps, and absolutely. I mean, it's a strategic decision across the board here. And, you know, I think it helps Sandoval to some degree when you're taking hits from the teachers union and the NPRI. You know,
on the right and the left.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You
NPRI
sort of,
is the right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you end up sort of looking, oh, this works out pretty well for me. I can
I can
extricate myself from sort of the very conservative wing of my party. And, well, the teachers, they always want more money here. So, what, of course, they're going to say here. So in that sense, I was, you know, the politics of it make a whole lot of sense there. But again,
but it's striking though that he's all alone as a Republican office holder. in taking that path, Republicans across the country?
Yes and no. I mean, you look in some of the other states where they've had, you know, some upticks in funding, and that money has been put back in education. So Chris Christie in New Jersey put a bunch of money in higher ed. The governor in Virginia did the same thing there, where there have been, you know, money did come in there on that one there. And, you know, everybody cares about education, so it makes it pretty easy. But again, you're not talking about restoring some of the most drastic cuts. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit of semantics there.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KUNV 91.5. This is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Kulikin. My guest today is UNLV political scientist and a friend of the program, Dave DeMore. We are discussing Governor Brian Sandoval's decision to allow taxes that were set to sunset to continue. I also want to talk about some other issues where the governor has shown perhaps some moderation, if only by not pursuing the kind of hard right policies with any forcefulness. For instance, immigration. That's one where we've seen Arizona, our neighbor to the south, have really taken up immigration, anti-immigration, or illegal immigration as an issue for its state legislature, even though it's technically a federal issue. Nevada Republicans have not really done that. There was some legislation introduced during the legislature, but it was certainly not a hill to die for on the part of the Republican governor, mm-hmm. or really any of the members of the legislature anyway, any of them who mattered. Why has there not been quite the so much heat on that issue in Nevada as opposed to Arizona? Is it just the fact that we don't have a share a border with
I think
Mexico?
The border state's a big issue here. The other part is one thing we have known, and there's a Pew study that sort of tracks this stuff, is what's been the consequences of the economic downturn on illegal immigration. And it's actually, you've seen a lot of illegal immigrants exit states like Nevada, as the construction industry sort of fallen apart and some of the other jobs that were filled in many cases by illegal labor. You know, that's the one positive, if you will, of the economic downturn. You sort of serve the illegal immigration, and there's some evidence suggesting they're moving now south into the booming economies in South America. So you're sort of seeing a reverse migration, if you will, there. So I think that goes into it there. I think, you know, the not being on the border there. And the other part of it is we, you know, maybe it's one of the blessings of having a part-time legislature is you don't have a lot of time to deal with these sort of...
Take up heated cultural issues.
Exactly. Yeah. In 120 days when you're trying to cobble together a budget, and in this case, you know, what kind of cuts we're going to make, where we're going to find some revenue there.
It also seems to me, I mean, you can agree or disagree with me here, that the hegemony, the sheer power of the Las Vegas Strip as the most dominant figure in Nevada politics keeps some of that stuff to a minimum.
Absolutely. I mean, they're dependent upon people coming here, conventions and business. And, you know, I think that Arizona got hurt on some of that stuff there. Some people were not going to take our business there. So that certainly plays into that as well, is why do you want to alienate? And you're going to alienate the fastest growing demographic in the state, right? And, you know, the Republicans are having trouble capturing Latino votes. That's not a way to get them. We know from the data that, you know, hardline immigration sort of ends the conversation, even if you have other issues, economic issues or other social issues. Mm-hmm. That becomes sort of the opener and the potential closer there. So I think all that stuff played into it. And, you know, Nevada doesn't have that sort of history, if you will, that you see in some of these other states there. I mean, you know, it's easy to point the finger at Arizona. They were former Confederate territory, for instance. And we just don't have that sort of history here. And there's been some discussion that, you know, where we have, you know, a few years ago we passed the gay marriage amendment in the Constitution here, that there's some discussion that that's, you know, we could become the gay marriage capital of the world here if we sort of mm-hmm. relax our attitudes on that. And you can very least become more tourist friendly to an important demographic there. So at the end of the day, the economics, I think, are really what trump everything else.
Mm-hmm. We discussed earlier State Senator Michael Roberson, who's leading the Republican effort to take the Senate. He seems to have, he seemed to have earlier in the year or late last year some wind at his back. Certainly a lot of lobbyists would love the idea of a Republican Senate that would sort of be counteract a Democratic assembly. How does that effort look now?
He's taken
some blows.
I mean, his fundraising's great. I mean, the fundraising has been very good for him. But the problem for him is instead of being three seats in play, now there's five. With Elizabeth House's resignation, that puts that seat up there. And then obviously
that's a Democratic district there.
And then Sheila Leslie's decision to change her residence and then essentially run against Greg Brower, where the Democrats have not been able to field a candidate there despite some recruitment efforts there. So now all of a sudden there's five seats in play instead of three, and you have the new seat down here where you probably have a fairly competitive Republican primary between two assembly members, Scott Hammond being the more moderate and then Richard MacArthur the more conservative. In that race there. So I think the board's gotten bigger and they now just need to win three of those five just to stay even. And they pretty much had four out of five to get the majority at, one seat majority here. The bigger problem for the Republicans is this is their best chance, I think, to get the majority in the Senate. They're going to have a tough time in 2014, given the seats that are going to be up. They're going to start losing some of their senior members. The Democrats have taken a lot of hits on them because of the term limits there. And just the force of those maps of the coming decade and the demographic changes that will continue, albeit a slower pace here, just do not favor the Republican
Party.
Talk
about that demographic change, because that will really have an impact on Nevada politics for
forever,
really.
Essentially.
And every year that demographic makeup changes.
Yeah,
tell us how.
If you look, in just the last decade, the census, the 2000 census, the 2010 census, the white population in Nevada decreased by 11%. The non-white population now about
the portion 40, of the
population. Portion of the population is now the non-white portion is 46%. At some point in the coming decade, we are going to be a majority minority state.
Like California,
New Mexico, Arizona's close, but they probably won't get there just because they're so big on that one there. And that's a huge change from the sort of traditional view of Nevada as this sort of white rural state here. Now we're one of the most diverse states in terms of our population. It's just not all Hispanics, right? 26% are Hispanic. You have about 10% African-American, 10% Asian Pacific Islander, so it's more diverse than just sort of Latinos and whites there. The other part is that it also increases the clout of the urban areas, right? Where all the growth in the last decade occurred was in the urban areas, predominantly down in southern Nevada, but to some degree up in Washoe County here. So now you have this tremendous concentration of demographically diverse individuals or population in very, very small geographic areas. So you look at Congressional District 1, the seat that Dina Titus is running for, Shelley Berkeley is giving up. That seat is one of the smallest geographic footprints in the whole country because it's so dense.
So dense.
And you have two-thirds of that district is non-white. So that is the core of Las Vegas. As that builds out, that's what you're going to see here. So, to the degree that density and diversity increase the Democratic vote, we certainly see that in steroids over in Nevada over the last decade. I mean,
right.
You essentially flipped the state from a Republican-leaning state in 2000 with the Republicans winning all the key elections, and then the Democrats did very well in 2006 and 2008, and they're still in a pretty good position. They had setbacks across
in 2010. Those changes, it seems to me, they help explain why that wave that came over the country in 2010 seemed to hit a bit of a seawall here in Nevada.
Not just here, but also Colorado. You saw the same thing happen in Colorado where you had a competitive Senate race, but the Democratic incumbent won there. You look in Nevada, great Republican year. What do they end up winning? Well, they hold the governorship. They beat Dina Titus by about 2,000 votes in Congressional District 3, and they picked up a total of three seats in the state legislature, two in the assembly and one in the state senate. Roberson's seat was the only one to be picked up. And then obviously Reed held his seat in the Senate there. So, yeah, a lot of that dealt with the fact that the Democrats had made such inroads with the Latino community over the last, you know, 4 or 5 cycles that, you know, really paid off that time around here. Now you start.
And Sharon Angle's campaign.
And Sharon Angle certainly helped that a lot, yeah, quite a bit there.
He ran some ads that were considered
absolutely
offensive.
Absolutely. On
and
that.
Those, the damage from that, does that last more than just a cycle?
I think it's a combination of things because you certainly have that. You have, you know, look at what Mitt Romney said on the trail. You know, he's pretty far right on a lot of the immigration issues, probably more so than he needs to be.
He felt like he had to get the nomination.
Exactly. Well, he said, I'll veto the DREAM Act, then call it a handout. He talked about, you know, self-deportation and some of those issues out there that I think are going to be harmful, and the Democrats are going to be sure to remind Latino voters of that. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, you know, recruitment of state legislative district candidates, right? So last time around, you increased the number of Latinos in the state house here from 2 to 8. All of them have D's next to their name. Republicans have recruited. There are some Latino Republicans running in some races.
And obviously the governor.
And the governor as well is in that one. But it's once you sort of get socialized, you get these partisan symbolic connections here, they become very, very difficult to break, particularly when you have this divided Republican Party where you still have a very strong anti-immigrant wing here and you have this sort of moderate Republicans are saying, no, you know, the business community doesn't want it. You know, it's bad for us politically here. But that's a bridge the Republicans have to sort of work on.
Mm-hmm. And one more statewide race this year, Dean Heller, the sitting senator who was appointed to the seat after John Ensign's resignation, running against Shelley Berkley, the congresswoman. How do you see that race going right now?
Well, it's going to be a close race. I think that race is in the margin of error all the way down to the down to November. I don't think we're gonna know. I think obviously Heller's now with the ethics stuff's not going away for Berkley. It provides a little bit, you know, something to hit her with. You've also noticed that Heller in the last 6 months has moderated quite a bit. You know, when he, you know, you go back in Dean Heller's history, he was sort of started off that way in Nevada politics. Then when he ran for that House seat and he got challenged
by a very conservative
exactly when
district.
Gibbons became the governor, gave up his House seat, and you end up the situation where he gets challenged by Sharon Angle in that primary. Club for Growth puts $1 million in that race, almost beats him, almost bankrupts him. He almost loses to Jill Derby, that safe Republican seat.
And the lesson he took from that was nobody's going to get to the right ever.
But now
all of a sudden he's statewide.
He's got to run statewide. He's not well known in Southern Nevada, even though he's been around for a while. So, you know, you're starting to see those dynamics there. But, I mean, it's largely going to happen. What talk of the ticket's going to drive so much of what's down the ticket.
So, the presidential campaign, if the Democrats have the kind of turnout machine they had in 2008, that could determine the fate of Dean Heller.
Absolutely.
My guest today has been Dave DeMore, political scientist at UNLV. That's our show. You've been listening to Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Hooligan, and this is 91.5 KUNV.